Here's one way to cut carbon emissions. Bury the stuff in farm fields. The Senate is considering a plan that would pay farmers to do just that as part of a climate and energy bill. The bill would essentially raise the cost of any fuel that emits carbon dioxide, the main contributor to climate change. As a result, farmers would see higher prices for their fuel and fertilizer. The payments for burying the carbon on their land would soften the blow, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The American Clean Energy and Security Act aims to make companies reduce the amount of carbon dioxide they emit or be penalized. Reducing emissions can be hard and expensive, so the bill creates something called an offset. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail card in Monopoly. A company could offset its emissions by paying someone else to get rid of carbon instead, someone who can do it more cheaply. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack recently told Congress that farmers would be delighted to get paid to store some of that carbon.
They'll be able, through the use of land, through cover crops, through altering how they use fertilizer, to how they raise livestock, to what they do with their land. I mean, there are a series of steps that can be taken and will be taken that will generate opportunities for offsets.
A good place to store carbon is in dirt, something farmers have a lot of. Dirt is full of organic matter, plant residue, microorganisms, earthworms. It's chock full of carbon. And theoretically, if you don't till the field, more of the carbon stays put. Guided by that belief, members of Congress want to allow farmers to sell offsets earned by no-till farming. Does it work? Scientists say maybe.
My name is Michelle Cavagelli. I'm a soil scientist with the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland.
Cavagelli shows me a no-till plot.
We have a corn crop on our left, and we have a soybean crop on our right. We might want to go inside the field a little bit. Okay, so I'm digging up the soil. You'll notice that when I break it apart, it breaks apart relatively easily. It's not a hard block like a brick.
Compared to a plowed field, this one has lots of dead vegetation in and on top of the dirt.
The percentage of organic matter in this soil, for example, is 2%. Twice as much as in some of the tilled systems at the very surface.
At the surface and down to about 4 inches or so. And the carbon will stay put if it isn't plowed. Plowing exposes the soil's organic matter to the air. It breaks down and the carbon goes up into the atmosphere.
If you till it, you can lose almost all the carbon you gained in the previous 5 years, say, with one tillage even. So one of the challenges is to maintain your no-till fields forever, in essence, to really gain the benefits of carbon sequestration.
But that doesn't fit in with the kind of no-till that most American farmers practice.
The reason is farmers plow 1 year and they do the no-till next year.
That's Ratan Lal, a soil scientist at Ohio State University. Moreover, Lal says research finds that no-till fields actually don't store any more carbon than plowed fields if you look deeper, say 3 feet down. So, do no-till fields really qualify as carbon offsets? Lal says they can store more carbon than a plowed field if the conditions are just right, the right kind of soil and soil temperature, for example. There's a possible conflict brewing here, though. Federal law and the energy bill encourage farmers to remove crop residue to make ethanol. And, says Lal,
that's a no-no. The moment you take the crop residue away, the benefits on no-till farming, on erosion control, water conservation, on carbon sequestration will not be realized.
Nonetheless, Lal supports no-till for carbon offsets, mostly because of how no-till fields are planted. When you don't plow, you use less fossil fuel to run equipment and make fertilizer.
Saving in diesel, saving in labor, saving in fertilizer consumption, saving in time.
These savings mean that no-till has a smaller carbon footprint than plowing. Farm interests are eager to win offsets for farmers, in part because they say the energy bill will raise their fuel costs across the board. The final list of what will be allowed in the bill could help win supporters when the Senate votes on the measure. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
In our next story, it's about a composer who sought to figure out how and why music has such a hold on our emotions. He says he gained an insight by writing music, not for humans, but for monkeys. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
David Tai is a cellist who plays with the National Symphony Orchestra and even on occasion with the heavy metal band Metallica. And he's a composer. He's also been developing a theory to explain why music plays on human emotions. His theory is that music relates to the most primitive sounds we make and respond to, like laughter, heartbeats, or a mother's cooing.
When I thought I had all the pieces put into place, I figured any good theory is testable. So one of the ways to test it would be to see if I could write music that would be effective for a species other than human.
He wrote to Chuck Snowden, a psychology professor who managed a colony of monkeys called cotton-top tamarins at the University of Wisconsin. Snowden says he was happy to cooperate, and he sent Tai recordings he'd made in the lab.
That's an animal that's being threatened by a veterinarian, so he's very upset. He's coming out to the front of the cage as though to attack or show aggressiveness.
Snowden also sent a sound that, believe it or not, monkeys make when they're feeling mellow. That's a quick one. Again? With those samples and a few others as a starting point, David Tai composed music for monkeys.
Basically, I took those elements and patterned them the way we do normally with music. You repeat them and take them up a third, or, you know. It was using the same kind of compositional techniques that are often used in human music.
He played the compositions on his cello and then electronically boosted them up 3 octaves to a pitch that matched the monkeys' voices. Monkeys don't respond at all to music written for humans, but they did respond when they heard this composition written specifically for them. Chuck Snowden says people may not be calmed by this relatively fast tempo, but the monkeys in his lab certainly were.
This is a rhythm that approaches the resting heart rate of a tamarin and had this calming effect on them, even though the pum-pum-pum-pum in the background was maybe a bit faster than we would expect as humans for this music.
Compare that with the music that Tai wrote to see if he could agitate the monkeys, a la Metallica.
Monkeys reacted to this by increasing their movement. They moved faster through their environment and also showed an increase in a whole variety of behaviors that we have associated with anxiety.
Snowden and Tai report these findings in the journal Biology Letters, and they argue they aren't simply sounds that imitate monkey voices. They are actually music. Tai says they are written on a staff, played on a musical instrument, and they have rhythm and tonal structure. But is it really music?
I wouldn't say so, to be honest.
Josh McDermott studies music and the brain at New York University.
There's always this sort of issue of how you ought to define music.
And in this case, McDermott says it's impossible to say whether the monkeys are reacting to the musical elements that Tai has added to the recordings, or simply to the sounds that mimic monkey voices. And that's the nub of the issue. Tai is, after all, trying to understand the nature of music, what makes it tug at his heartstrings. It's a question so powerful, at first he was afraid even to ask it.
The paradox is that I distinctly remember thinking once that when they figure out why Puccini makes me cry, I hope I die the day before the news gets out. But the great news about this exploration into music is that it's actually more magical and wonderful once you realize how it works.
In fact, Tai is now hoping to use his insights to compose music that will appeal to other species and to trigger even deeper emotional reactions in us. Richard Harris, NPR News.
You can hear more monkey calls and the songs they inspired at the new NPR.org.
Lasers are incredibly useful. Think of your CD player or the supermarket checkout scanner. And some lasers are so small they can fit on a computer chip. But those lasers look huge next to the latest development. As NPR's Richard Harris reports, scientists say that they have built the world's smallest laser and that it opens up all sorts of new possibilities.
Conventional wisdom has it that lasers can only be miniaturized so far. That's because to create a laser beam, a light literally bounces around inside of a chamber. And since a light wave has a certain length, it essentially needs room to turn around. But 6 years ago, Mark Stockman at Georgia State University started thinking outside the box.
I've got an idea to create a laser whose size is not limited to conventional limitation of laser.
Stockman realized that a rapidly vibrating electron sitting on the surface of a tiny piece of metal could actually produce laser light.
This is a nanopendulum, basically. They can be confined to almost any small place.
In 2003, Stockman issued a challenge to the growing field of nanotechnology. Figure out how to build these vibrating electrons, or nanopendulums, in real life. They're called plasmons, by the way. Many research groups took up the challenge, and in the past few months, three have declared victory. One is a team that includes Mikhail Noganov at Norfolk State University. They made a laser out of a bead of gold that's so small you can't even see it under the microscope. It's just 44 nanometers across.
For the comparison, the thickness of the human hair is 50 micrometers. So our device is about 1,000 times smaller than that.
Now, Noganov didn't just build the world's smallest laser for bragging rights. Lasers on the scale can produce tiny light sources, which in turn can help scientists capture images of tiny things we really care about, like the molecules inside our bodies. But the biggest potential here may be a new generation of computers. They could be 1,000 times faster than computers today, but of course they have to be wired into a circuit.
If you want to use it in electronics, you want to attach it with wires to the rest of the circuit.
And that's the challenge. It's not so easy to accomplish using Noganov's free-floating bead of gold. But other research groups are hot on that trail. One is in the Netherlands. Another is at the University of California, Berkeley. Shuang Zhang at Cal is author of a new paper in Nature. His group's current nanolaser can, in theory, be put right onto a computer chip.
All the processes we're using here is already used in the semiconductor manufacturing. So I would not think it will take too long to reach a real application, maybe a few years.
And those real applications could include future generations of computer storage. Impressed they can already cram a whole movie onto a DVD? Those are burned with today's lasers. Zhang says there's plenty of room for improvement.
For example, you can use this to make a very high-density DVD recorders. You may be able to store the whole library into one disk.
An entire library on a disk?
Right.
Wow.
That's a possibility.
Of course, the most exciting thing about new technologies is you never know where they will lead. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Here's one way to cut carbon emissions. Bury the stuff in farm fields. The Senate is considering a plan that would pay farmers to do just that as part of a climate and energy bill. The bill would essentially raise the cost of any fuel that emits carbon dioxide, the main contributor to climate change. As a result, farmers would see higher prices for their fuel and fertilizer. The payments for burying the carbon on their land would soften the blow, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports.
The American Clean Energy and Security Act aims to make companies reduce the amount of carbon dioxide they emit or be penalized. Reducing emissions can be hard and expensive, so the bill creates something called an offset. It's kind of like a get-out-of-jail card in Monopoly. A company could offset its emissions by paying someone else to get rid of carbon instead, someone who can do it more cheaply. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack recently told Congress that farmers would be delighted to get paid to store some of that carbon.
They'll be able, through the use of land, through cover crops, through altering how they use fertilizer, to how they raise livestock, to what they do with their land. I mean, there are a series of steps that can be taken and will be taken that will generate opportunities for offsets.
A good place to store carbon is in dirt, something farmers have a lot of. Dirt is full of organic matter, plant residue, microorganisms, earthworms. It's chock full of carbon. And theoretically, if you don't till the field, more of the carbon stays put. Guided by that belief, members of Congress want to allow farmers to sell offsets earned by no-till farming. Does it work? Scientists say maybe.
My name is Michelle Cavagelli. I'm a soil scientist with the USDA in Beltsville, Maryland.
Cavagelli shows me a no-till plot.
We have a corn crop on our left, and we have a soybean crop on our right. We might want to go inside the field a little bit. Okay, so I'm digging up the soil. You'll notice that when I break it apart, it breaks apart relatively easily. It's not a hard block like a brick.
Compared to a plowed field, this one has lots of dead vegetation in and on top of the dirt.
The percentage of organic matter in this soil, for example, is 2%. twice as much as in some of the tilled systems at the very surface.
At the surface and down to about 4 inches or so. And the carbon will stay put if it isn't plowed. Plowing exposes the soil's organic matter to the air. It breaks down and the carbon goes up into the atmosphere.
If you till it, you can lose almost all the carbon you gained in the previous 5 years, say, with one tillage even. So one of the challenges is to maintain your no-till fields forever, in essence, to really gain the benefits of carbon sequestration.
But that doesn't fit in with the kind of no-till that most American farmers practice.
The reason is farmers plow 1 year and they do the no-till next year.
That's Ratan Lal, a soil scientist at Ohio State University. Moreover, Lal says research finds that no-till fields actually don't store any more carbon than plowed fields if you look deeper, say 3 feet down. So, do no-till fields really qualify as carbon offsets? Lal says they can store more carbon than a plowed field if the conditions are just right, the right kind of soil and soil temperature, for example. There's a possible conflict brewing here, though. Federal law and the energy bill encourage farmers to remove crop residue to make ethanol. And, says Lal,
that's a no-no. The moment you take the crop residue away, the benefits on no-till farming, on erosion control, water conservation, on carbon sequestration will not be realized.
Nonetheless, Lal supports no-till for carbon offsets, mostly because of how no-till fields are planted. When you don't plow, you use less fossil fuel to run equipment and make fertilizer.
Saving in diesel, saving in labor, saving in fertilizer consumption, saving in time.
These savings mean that no-till has a smaller carbon footprint than plowing. Farm interests are eager to win offsets for farmers, in part because they say the energy bill will raise their fuel costs across the board. The final list of what will be allowed in the bill could help win supporters when the Senate votes on the measure. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.